We have an Olympian on the show today with a rowing career leading him to a fourth place finish in the 2016 Rio Olympics. Hans Struzina has a unique perspective on sports recovery. He started rowing at a very early age, but his career really exploded during his collegiate career, where he helped the Washington Huskies to two varsity eight national titles, and then obviously leading to the Olympics in 2016 after that. We talk about entering the pain cave as an athlete. I know many of you will be able to relate to that, if not all of you. So that is going to be an interesting conversation, as well as what it was like to be at the Olympics in 2016, and of course, his recovery routine. Let's get into it.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Hey, Hans, it's great to have you on the show.
And then, Jace, I appreciate you having me on, bro. It's great to be here. I'm glad we got connected and you asked me on, so I'm excited to share some stuff with your audience.
Yeah, I'm really eager to hear a rowing perspective, because in our podcast, we have a lot of different sports that come on, but it's not too often a rower comes on here. And that's like so out of my world that I'm anxious for some insights that I wouldn't get from like the endurance running side of things. So, but I want to ask you first, like, how do you get into rowing? Because sometimes you don't always start with the sport that you end up, you know, making the full-time commitment for. So what was that for you? Was it rowing from the beginning, or how did you get started in sport?
No, I mean, rowing, as you can imagine, and anyone listening, it's a prep sport. It's kind of fringy in so much as it's not common, and you know, not everyone knows rowers, right? But in Seattle, where I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, it's a big sport. Sure. The University of Washington has a really strong rowing tradition. And in fact, it's the second oldest sport on campus, only behind football. And I think it's like a year apart, or maybe I'm really backwards on that. Maybe rowing's older, but either way, if you've ever been to the Pacific Northwest, you know that there's water everywhere and there's lakes and the Puget Sound. So it's very visible because there's floating bridges and everyone crossing by can see it. And, so it's a more known sport there. Sure. So I was like many kids trying every single sport, basketball, football, track, all that kind of stuff. And I love sports. I was athletic, but I had success as sort of an elementary school kid, but eventually, gosh, just got outgrown. Everyone hit puberty before me.
Yeah.
And I 1 year I was competitive and the next year I'm the smallest kid. It's like, you know, that's just how it is sometimes. And so, I wasn't doing a sport, my parent that summer. And so my parents found out that we could do, rowing lessons down on the lake.
Okay.
And, privately, just the four of us, is like an activity for the family to do, which was kind of fun. So we did. Yeah. And, it kind of just took off from there. The coaches were like, oh, you know, you guys should try the rec team in the summer, which was a 3 week program. And then sign up for the fall program, which was, you know, every day after school. And from there, it just kind of snowballed.
Yeah. And when you say the four of us, you mean your parents, yourself, and I believe you have a sister.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And then were you able to do the rec, like, team like with your whole family, or was that then you were split
that was
into
like
your
the
age
youth
group and,
rec
and stuff.
Program and so I was all of a sudden in there with kids my age, and you know, just rowing is really beautiful when it's done well, but it's awful to watch when it's not. So we were out there flopping around, you know, jumping out of the boat, swimming, because it's if the Pacific Northwest is beautiful in the summer, so we were taking advantage of that and goofing around and having a good time.
I can only imagine doing like a rowing event with a bunch of young kids, because I remember my family took a family trip up to Itasca, Minnesota, where they have all these lakes and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And my brother and I don't even know how old we were, but it's grade school. And we were in a canoe by ourselves. We can never go the right way. Literally go from one bank to the other and like not down the middle of the river at all. And we're stuck completely. All the time.
and you think about it, like in a rowing shell, you're flipped around backwards. So you're going, you're facing the stern and you gotta turn around and look. And then when you're in the eight, you have a coxswain who sits in the stern and steers and has a microphone. Person barely knows what they're doing, and the rowers don't know what they're doing. It's like a total disaster sometimes. Yeah.
Have you ever ran into another boat?
Gosh, not seriously. No, I mean, I've had a few like people run into me, or I've run into them on the land. You know, there's been a couple of races where we've gotten into clashes, because in the fall you do what's called head racing, where you basically go on a buoyed course or down a river or something. Oh, cool. And it's time trials. Yeah. And so, you know, when you're overtaking or going under a bridge and turning, like those, you can connect with the other boat physically sometimes. So those get kind of fun, but ideally you're not actually contacting anybody.
But there's actually
a really good video, to you or your audience. Go onto YouTube and type in like the Snowflake Regatta. There's this race in upper New York somewhere where it's like the exact definition of what I'm talking about. It's like these kids who don't know how to row rowing around, like slamming into each other, slamming into the docks, like, and the parents are on the bank screaming at it. It's hilarious. So if you want a good laugh, go check that one out.
All right. Yeah. I'll try to find that and put it in the show notes for the people. So that event is not an Olympic sport, or they just not show it? Because I've only seen where it's like, you know, you're in your lane and you're just going straight.
So the rowing, kind of like indoor track and outdoor track, you've got spring and a fall, and the fall is all the head races. So it's all, you know, somewhere between 3 and 10K. Usually it's like 5 or 6K is a pretty standard distance. But yeah, three to five is somewhere in that world. And you go on a river, or you go around a buoyed course on a lake or something like that. And that's kind of what you prep for in the fall. And then it goes to the sprint racing, which is the 2000 meters. Okay. Think like, you know, buoys in a pool, but it's a 2000 meter course, and everyone's going down their lane and just trying to get to the finish line first.
Okay, cool.
And that's the Olympic distance. And that's what the Olympics are. Yeah.
Do you prefer one event over the other, or?
I was always generally a little better at the 2K. You know, it's fun racing the head races, is that's what we call them, as a head race. Yep. But it's, I don't know. I wasn't as good at them, just my physiology, I think. So I would say I was better at the 2K, and I like those a little better.
Yeah. So, and it sounds like you grew up in a pretty big high school as well.
I actually went to a really small high school, but my rowing program, Sammamish Rowing Association, was actually the biggest, you know, collection of kids in the Pacific Northwest from a headcount. My graduating class in high school was like 82 kids. It was, it's not tiny, but it was not big.
I got you beat. I had 17 in my high school.
Yeah, you do. So. You got me beat, no doubt. Yeah.
But yeah. That's what South Dakota is all about, the small schools. But okay, so what was kind of your thought process? I know you said you were kind of outgrown in some of these other sports, but was there anything besides your athletic ability that you're like, I want to do rowing besides, you know, football, basketball, wrestling, whatever? Or was it simply like, hey, I am a competitor and I want to win?
That's a hard question to unpack. So I joined the rowing team. I had some decent success as a first year kid. You know, I was pulling some decent scores on the rowing machine, and I was picking up the stroke, because it's just as much about timing and sort of the balance and the flow as it is about power and endurance. And it has to come together well for the boat to work, to go fast. And so you know, I was doing okay at it, but it took me a while to like figure the sport out and to really like it.
Sure.
And frankly, I almost quit because
why?
You can imagine in December, January, February, it's really cold, rainy, and dark, and we don't go on the water. So you're in the boathouse. And in our case, it was like a shed. It was a large shed that used to be a sewage treatment pump for the county, like the county wastewater something or other.
Yeah.
And then they took all their equipment out, and then we put boat racks in, and there was no insulation and no plumbing.
Oh, man.
So, you know, it's like kind of janky little situation there, but
yeah,
pretty miserable in the winter. So I was really not feeling it at the time, but
okay.
I stuck with it, and I got to the sprints racing season through the encouragement of a lot of the other kids who had been on the team a couple of years and were like, no, you don't know what the sport's about until you do, you know, these races. And sure, they were right, turns out. And I really fell in love with the sport when we got into the sprint racing and just the kind of, it was, you know, there's a camaraderie that comes together when a boat starts to click and everyone's pushing the right way and putting their blade in the water the right time. And that part really got me. And then on top of that, I didn't have to like tackle somebody or out jump somebody. And at the time I was not particularly good at either. So I liked that it was about my physical effort and then also how it works with a team. And so once I figured that out, I was like, okay, this is a good sport. I'm into this.
Yeah. Cool. So when you like decided that, did you quit everything else and just focus on that, or were pretty multi-sport? Yeah. Okay. What age was that?
Let's see. I would have been like 14 or 15, 14. Okay. Yeah, I was 14 when I picked it up, and really maybe I would turned 15 and then I figured it out. So I was right about there.
Okay. So right around freshman in high school or so.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So obviously rowing is a unique sport when it comes to like rowing versus say basketball or running, where you have to have controlled strength. And like I would imagine it's kind of like swimming, where you could work a lot harder but not go any faster.
Right.
So what's it like balancing that strength but also technique in a sport?
I mean, you nailed it. It's, you could work a lot harder and the boat could slow down. And so absolutely learning the physics of the boat, how it accelerates and decelerates in the water, and then, you know, how different boat classes do. So, you know, a single, you're just one person in the boat.
Yeah.
Top end speed is not nearly as high, obviously, as an 8-person boat, but it also slows down a lot faster when you're between the time you take your blade out of the water and put it back in for the next stroke. Whereas an 8 obviously can get up to a really high speed and it won't slow down as much just because there's a lot more momentum and stuff, but it takes more to get it up to speed because it's 1,000 pounds of people.
Yeah.
Boat, right. Or a couple thousand pounds. So learning the physics of it is absolutely critical. And when you start to figure out like not only the physics of how to move the boat, but also then how your body kind of acts in the fulcrum of the rowing stroke, because you think you have this big long oar, it's attached to the boat, your seat moves, and then there's a pivot point, right?
Okay.
And you have to figure that out. And then you start to recognize like, if I, you know, hook onto the water and then I accelerate it this certain way, we go faster. And if I slap the water and I do it this other way, we slow down. And then what exercises can I do on the land? Yeah. And so that can really help me leverage that.
Yeah.
It's a fine balance, as it were, about, you know, having the technical ability, but also the power once you figure out the tech.
So how do you like mentally go throughout a race? Because I would imagine, like, again, when you're running, you're like, okay, just push harder. It's, you know, you don't really have to think about it. You just keep running. Whereas I would, like, you don't want to panic in a sport where you have to focus on so many things. Or do you get to a point where it's just like, you can just keep pushing harder?
Yeah. So rowing is interesting because you go from anaerobic to aerobic back to anaerobic in the course of a 2K, and you're, you know, depending on the level at which you're rowing, you know, world record is down around five, or it's just under 5 minutes, 20 seconds for the men's eight. And, okay, you know, so you're five at the high levels, you're at 5.5 minutes, roughly, you're at 6 minutes, you know, in high school, college world, yeah, or somewhere in between that. So the first minute of the race is all just anaerobic. You're, you know, it's all, you're building lactic acid, you're building power, you're getting the boat up to speed. And then you have to settle down, bring your strokes per minute down a little bit to something a little more sustainable. And then it's aerobic for like 3-4 minutes. And, you know, in there are some times when you have to push, you have to, you know, try and speed up one split or whatever it is. But generally you're trying to be consistent and just add as you go. Mm-hmm. And then the last minute and change is, you know, you're just driving for the finish line as hard as you can possibly go. And that's when you spike your heart rate back up and that lactic acid comes back into play. And then you cross the finish line and you vomit or whatever.
Does everybody have to be like pulling at the same strength? Otherwise you're gonna go some
two different disciplines. There's sweep rowing, which each guy or gal has one oar, and then there's sculling, where each person has two. And so sweep rowing is what I went to the Olympics in, and what most people think of when they row, or when they think of rowing. But, you know, I also sculled for many years and went to the World Championships in the men's quad a couple times at the under 23 and senior level. So I did both. And even then, you know, you have to like kind of be even to push the boat straight. So yeah, there's some balance on, you know, one side or the other too.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I was just picturing that there's eight people on boat all with two oars, but it's really everybody has one. So there's four on one side, four on the other.
Yeah. So that's the eight. And then there's a boat class called the Oct, which is eight people with two oars. And those, they don't race because they're too fast. You can't slow them down. And if you have a misstroke and you do what's called catching a crab, where your oar goes under the water and it like hits, you know, literally hits you in the face. You're riding a bike downhill and you are at the top gear and you're pedaling, but you're not actually pushing the flywheel anymore. You're just spinning. Like that's what the Oct is like when it's up to speed. And so it gets a little dangerous when you're trying to like turn or steer or something, you know, or stop. Obviously that's a tough one too.
Yeah. cool. So let's get into your Olympic experience.
Definitely.
In 2016, obviously, there was some controversy about was it like a pandemic type of situation back then in Rio? Or I remember there's some conflict, but I can't remember.
The Zika virus. That's what everyone was freaking out about then.
So
which
it's funny how now 4 years ago we have, you know, COVID-19, which is interesting. Right. But go ahead, what you're gonna say.
Well, I was just saying the one thing, I mean, the media does this, and I actually was talking to my neighbor about this last night. They always pick a couple of topics and just harp on them. And it's like, it's going to be a total disaster. This country is not prepared. And to be fair, Rio was not totally ready, but the Zika thing was not a non-factor, because what everyone forgot was that it was basically winter down there because they're below the equator. And so it was reverse seasons. Even though it was July, it's middle of winter. There's no mosquitoes in the winter. Like they don't hatch. It's not a thing, right? So if we were there in December, it would have been a big problem, but we weren't. So that would number one. And then the water quality, people getting sick from being out in the water was number two. And we did take some precautions to make sure that everyone was staying healthy. But as far as I'm aware, very few, if anybody got sick from water quality.
Okay. Cool. So obviously you're probably dreaming of the Olympics from a very young age. Tell us the story about you qualifying. How did that happen?
Yeah. So the story really starts in 2015 when we were in the World Championships in Aubelette, France, and this gorgeous mountain race course is so cool, but it was a really bad performance from all of the men's boats from the United States in general. We did not perform well across the board as a team. And I was in the quad, which is the four guys with two oars each. We didn't do well. The eight didn't do well. The four underperformed, et cetera. So basically that regatta is really important because it claims spots for the Olympics for the following year relative to qualifying. Cause there's only so many boats that are allowed per boat class.
Yeah.
And they name all but two of them based on your finishing position. And the United, we didn't qualify a bunch of boats. And so fast forward almost a year later, they have what's called a last chance regatta. And it's in Lucerne, Switzerland, another beautiful mountain race course. And it's literally like what it sounds like. You get one shot to go down the race course and the top two finishers across the finish line go to the Olympics and everyone else is done. And so from basically late August until that point, I had no idea if we were even going to go. We were training, put lives on hold, you know, didn't show up for weddings, you name it. It was all training all day, every day. And so we go to this race. The boat got selected. We show up. We're doing okay. I mean, it's like, this is it. This is happening.
Yeah.
And everyone's nervous. And we have a decent race. We don't get out of the blocks the right way, 100%, but we had enough power to sort of make it up. And I remember very distinctly at 500 meters to go, so the last quarter of the race, thinking, I have a choice to make right now. One, I can sort of just glide it in and be like, you tried, you did it. It's just like, this isn't in the cards. Or you can spend the next a minute and 20 seconds, you know, in the pain cave going as deep as you can with and for the guys that are in this boat. And if we come up short, then at least you left it out there. And I remember having that conversation. I was like, I'm not going to swear on your podcast, but I was like, F it, let's go. Yeah. And we dug in as a team. I think everyone else had that same feeling in that moment because we were out of qualifying position. We came back on the Polish who were first. We caught them with like a couple of strokes to go and we passed them at some point and we ended up winning the race. Wow. And there were three boats within a quarter second.
Holy
cow. I think it was like 0.23 seconds, three boats. So, you know, you've got a 60-foot long boat and that's about, you know, 4 feet or whatever it is. So
could you even tell that you had won at that point? Cause you're all facing the wrong way.
Well, I could because I was in the two seats. So I was up in the bow.
Okay.
And there's kind of this weird tunnel vision thing that happens as you sit further in the stern, but because I was up on the bow, I could see that I didn't have any other rowers next to me, which means our bow ball was ahead, but the other guys, like they just see rowers next to them. They have no idea if it's the two seat or the five seat or what, you know, where they're sitting.
Wow.
But yeah, that's crossed the finish line and was like, oh man, I have not juiced the end of a race like that in my entire life. And everyone else probably felt the same. And it was crazy. Our time at the last 500 was a minute and 20 seconds. And that's, you know, world record pace. On a race course with no wind, and all the world records are set with wind. So that, like, I mean, everyone dug the heck in and we got it done. So it was a pretty awesome experience.
Wow. That's so cool. Great story. That like that gave me chills listening to that part.
Yeah, man.
So.
There's, if you go to worldrowing.com, maybe after we're done, I'll send you the link, but you can throw the video of it up in the show notes. It's a good one.
So that story reminds me, I was reading your, some past articles of your Kirkland, newspaper where you kind of grew up in, and they were recapping that event and then your Olympics and that kind of stuff. And you were quoted saying that it's a pain contest. Who can outlast the next guy will win. And I think that's very relatable in any racing sport. Because at the end of the day, if you're the same trained, it's whoever can hurt the worst.
Oh, yeah.
So my question is, how do you mentally like get into a space where you can focus on hurting, because it takes a ton of mental energy to be like, okay, a minute and 20 seconds doesn't sound like a long time until like you feel like your forearms are going to pop off, and then, you know, right, it feels like 3 hours.
Well, you're and your heart rate's at 192, yeah, or whatever it is, and you've already been going as hard as, yeah, you can for, you know, 4 minutes and change at that point. How do you get to that mental state, practice simply? Mm-hmm. It's something, I mean, frankly, you have to be a little weird and a little messed up in the head to like want to do that, and to be able to like, and frankly, there's probably some like, you know, unseated, unresolved, like childhood stuff that like makes someone want to do that, yeah, right, to some degree. Or maybe like, you know, someone made fun of you once and you just channeled it into this, uh-huh, into this sport. And I would argue that, you know, the Olympic Village is full of people with chips on their shoulder for one reason or another. Yeah. And it's so there's an element of that, but it's also just like what you said, like I just knew like I had a motor that most people don't have. It turns out one of the reasons I'm good at this sport is because I have a really large lung capacity, and I would always test in the top couple of people on the team, even though I was not the tallest. I had just huge VO2 max capacity. Mm-hmm. I had it that equivalent of like someone who should be like 6'8" and I'm 6'2". So I just like big lungs, yeah, right? And so I could just push really far for really long, yeah, and go deep when other people just physically couldn't. Yeah. And so there's a physiological advantage, but then there's also like, I trained it. I had a lot of good coaches along the way who pushed me, mm-hmm, who saw potential and just told me, you know, you're not done yet. You got to keep going. There's more to give, you know, there's more that's possible. Yeah. And as I started to see, you know, on the training pieces, like good results, and it was like, okay, I went a little faster, but that didn't hurt as bad as I thought it would. And then you trust yourself a little bit more. So the next one, you go a little harder. And you're like, okay, that didn't die on that one. Like, mm-hmm, okay, go a little harder. And you just do that for years and years, yeah, and years, and you find out, you know, how deep the rabbit hole goes. And I just kept finding it could go a little deeper.
Yeah. Building confidence in the pain by going in it baby steps. It kind of sounded like, right, you know, so, okay, I'm pushing with, you know, 30 seconds out and I made it. So why not try 40 seconds next time, you know? Right. That, yeah, makes a lot of sense. And I had the opposite, not to go too deep into my career, but it's a valid point here where like you were building that confidence. At one point in my career, I had, so I was a 410 miler my sophomore year of college. And
so fast.
but the following summer I had heat exhaustion, and just something got messed up with my lungs or what have you, and I just wasn't able to finish like I was before, and that kind of slowly eroded my confidence. So then, mm-hmm, it took another like year and a half for me to get back. After we figured out what was going on, I got an inhaler. I couldn't ever go to the well like I could when I was a sophomore because of that lack of confidence until towards the end. I started kind of realizing, yeah, what was happening. But that makes a lot of sense where you have to build something like that as well. But do you do anything as a routine to kind of like get your mind set right or clear, yeah, prior to the race or the night before?
Yeah. There was a couple of things that I always picked up on, and my coach, who was my freshman coach at University of Washington, who also happened to be the Olympic coach, you know, for whatever it was, 8 years later. Mm-hmm. He taught us a lesson early on that was, as freshmen, so we're 18, 19 years old, going to race the national championship, like, you know, being nervous is good. It means you care, and it means that your body is like prepping you. And then B, like everyone else feels the same exact, yeah, way. And And so I always took that as like, because everyone wants to talk about like how not to be nervous for something.
Yeah, it's
and wonderful. I, right, exactly. I cut that out pretty quickly. And I was like, I'm going to be so nervous and I'm going to feel it, but that's normal. I'm that's like a checkbox that I'm like, okay, good. And I would always just think about how do I get that going in the right mm-hmm. direction? So in my case, you know, straight down the race course, yeah. as opposed to all over the place. And then my energy is going every direction. Yeah. Like I just want it to go straight down the race course. And so that was a big one. And then secondly is simply that it's going to hurt and you kind of have to wrap your head around that fact. And the fact that it hurts, it also is not a bad mm-hmm. thing. That's just normal. That's just yeah. part of the deal, with endurance sports. And, you know, so frankly, that like getting your mind right before you get there so that when it hurts, you're not surprised or you're not upset mm-hmm. or you're not whatever. That's huge. Yeah. I think,
I think you said it very well. Like the first thing you said, I actually interviewed Austin O'Brien, who is Olympic trials marathoner, and he used the term nervous-sided. He's like, yeah, I'm nervous, mm-hmm. but I'm excited. And that's what I'm going to focus on.
Right.
But then I'm drawing a brain fart here.
Well, I'll
go ahead.
I'll add a moment while you collect whatever it is you're going to say. But anytime that you're nervous, again, it means you care and you're excited. Nervous sided. I love that.
Yeah.
And then once you actually get into the race, that goes away yeah. and you don't care anymore.
100%. Right?
Because all you got to do is like get yourself to the starting line and like get, in our case, your first stroke.
Yeah.
Just make sure your first stroke is good. Don't rip through the water. Don't over jerk it or whatever. Don't turn yeah. the boat unnecessarily, whatever it was. And then just take the second stroke mm-hmm. and the third stroke. And now you're getting up to speed. Now you're feeling in your rhythm and your muscle memory takes over. I'm sure same with you. The gun goes off and you take those first couple of strides yeah. out and you're like, okay, I'm striding out now. I'm in it. Now I know what to do.
Yeah. It almost primes the focus. Like, I think that's what yeah. the excitement does. So then when the gun goes off, you're immediately focused on the goal instead of trying to have to, okay, I'm racing now. Okay. Now I'm focused. It primes that. But what I was going to say is you said, you know, the second thing is getting ready to hurt. And I think yeah. once you get comfortable with the mm-hmm. fact that it's going to hurt, it actually like provides some sort of security and like, okay, I know it's coming, you know, instead of like right. trying to avoid it. I think that's what some athletes, like a big mental hurdle for athletes is trying to avoid the pain, like visualizing themselves going through the event without pain. Like that's mm-hmm. never going to happen. So when mm-hmm. I started visualizing myself in the pain, but going through it, that's when I really started to see some, you know, change in how I was handling the end of the races.
So. Right. Yeah. And we always talked about in college, you know, anyone can row 1,000 meters, but this, what's going to separate you is that third 500, because that's when it really sucks usually. Yeah. And it's really the least fun because you're still a couple minutes from the finish yep. line, but you're over halfway done. And that's where people break mentally. Mm-hmm. And then at the national level, it's more like, you know, 1250, 1300, anyone can go to 1250, but you know, that next 750 is yeah. where champions are made basically. Yeah. And, you know, being willing to go to those places and then know it's coming. And then when that opportunity presents itself, yeah. that's when you jump on it. You know, that's when you win yeah. races.
Cool. So we got down a little bit rabbit hole, but it was a good rabbit hole here, but I want to go.
For sure.
So now you've made it to the Olympics. Just kind of walk us through your experience at the Olympics and, what happened there? I know you know, placed fourth, but what was just the environment like?
Yeah, it's in our Olympics, it was unique because oftentimes the rowing venue is hours outside of the city. Okay. And so they set up like a little, you know, water sport village. So it's basically all the people from rowing. And then at the second week is canoe, kayak, okay, and all that stuff. Our event was downtown Rio and on the lago there. And so we were staying in the village. So we had a little bit of a different experience than past, teams have had.
Okay.
But yeah, it was crazy. I mean, there's, you know, everyone's wearing their gear all the time. Yeah. You're seeing these like very famous athletes walking into the dining hall. You see like, oh, there's North Korea and there's, yeah, you know, Russia, most of the Russian athletes, weren't allowed to participate. And so they were like the brand list or the country list athletes or whatever they called them at that games. Yeah. And, because of the whole doping scandal and all that, which is another topic, but, you know, you kind of get into this like, wow, this is it. This is happening. This is like the thing. So there's definitely a surreal aspect to it, but then there's also like an energy of like, we're finally here. That's really cool. We're finally here. And like, OMG, I cannot believe we're at the Olympic Games. And then like, I'm so glad it's almost done because this, no matter what people finish, and admittedly, like, I was devastated by our result, I also had a sense of relief that it was finally over because it had built, I had been building to it for so long. And it's hard to explain, but like when it's done, it's like, I don't have to train anymore. I can just be a person for a little while here. And so there was some of that too.
Yeah. So was that your last race then ever? Was that the Olympics?
Yeah, I didn't know it at the time, but yes, that was, it turns out that was my last like official high level competition race. I've done, you know, alumni stuff and fun throw together things here and there with some of the guys, but yeah, no, that was it. That was all.
Yeah. So you got fourth. How close were you to third?
I think we were like 2 seconds or less. I honestly don't remember. I've watched that race a grand total of one time. And, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't dwell on it. Here's what I know is anybody who makes the A final has a shot at a medal. I don't care what they finished in the A final. What it comes down to is how they just execute and a little bit of luck on that day. If you re-race that race the next day, there's very possible that we medal and the other guys don't or whatever. Yeah. Like there's some really talented athletes at that level and that's just what it is, but that's why you race it on the day. And, but yeah, so we were on paper looking good for a medal or had the shot at it. And, you know, we got as close as you could get without actually hitting it. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, anybody listening to this though is like, okay, yeah, he got fourth, but you made the stinking Olympics. Like,
Well, it's yes. But you know, the goal was not just to make the team, of course, like we weren't just happy to be there.
100%.
You know, and there's yes, there is a sense of like, you're happy to be there cause you made it and other guys from the country didn't. And so there's some gratitude and some excitement around that. Yeah. But like the goal was to come home with hardware, and you know, no one has an Olympic dream and thinks I want to be fifth.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone thinks about themselves sitting on the gold medal stand, right? Or standing on the gold medal stand.
Yeah. 100%. So, okay. Well, you were talking about the time from when you had that last chance meet and then up to that you had like no life, you know, it was all training and that kind of stuff. I would imagine there's very high expectations on you to stay healthy and have, you know, a regimented routine to make sure that, you know, when that day comes that you are not only in the best shape of your life, but, you know, 100% healthy so you can perform the best. Right. So what was your like recovery routine during that stage of your life?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll say it this way is, you know, you said like, we didn't have a life and I had one of my teammates, we were out there racing in the morning one morning, and you could tell the boat was just sluggish. Mm-hmm. And he spoke up and said, if anyone doesn't want to be in this boat right now, if there's anywhere you'd rather be, just raise your hand and get the hell out, you know, and we'll get the launch over here and swap you with somebody because, you know, you need to want to be here. Yeah. And I remember being like, that was harsh, but I thought about it for a little bit and I was like, he's right. Like, I really think about anywhere else, like in the whole wide world, it's like, I wouldn't rather be anywhere but trying to make this team and being in this boat. So relative to recovery, it was, you know, that honestly guided almost everything I did from when I went to sleep to what I ate. My personal side of it was like, I was big nutrition guy. Mm-hmm. So I was always kind of monitoring what I was eating, how much I weighed, et cetera. Sure. And I was really just religious about what I ate. I actually was, interestingly enough, vegetarian before dinner,
okay,
which a lot of people don't know, but I was
dinner as in the evening meal.
Yeah, right. Okay. So everything, you know, my shake in the morning, eggs with rice and all that stuff, lunch, et cetera. I just wasn't doing tons of meat. Cause I knew I could, but I it was a health choice and I was performing just fine.
So what was your basis, like from a health standpoint, why did that make sense to you to do, you know, vegetarian till dinner?
My wife was a vegetarian while she was training. She's a lightweight athlete. And so she had to always be conscious of her weight. And so that, and she was a girlfriend at the time, and she was sharing a lot of the science that she was studying. Okay. And, frankly, it was, I mean, and I, in between practices, read a lot of books and watched a lot of documentaries about anything and everything I could sort of consume to help me. You know, and there were at the time a lot of documentaries coming out about sort of the ecological impacts of meat and the meat industry, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, the link to heart disease, sure. and various other things that I was consuming at the time. And so I just said, you know, I'll try this and see what happens. And I experimented with that, you know, different types of, you know, like bulletproof coffee, different types of shakes, protein from different sources, like, you know, plant sources versus meat sources and all that stuff. And I really just felt after I tried them all in different combinations, mm-hmm. I dialed one in that, and I just started feeling really good. And that happened to be not eating tons of meat except for a dinner.
Okay. Did you ever try to cut it out completely?
Not while I was training, no, because I wasn't, because I mean, frankly, I was eating 6,000-8,000 calories a day. And that's a lot of freaking vegetables, man, to get to the protein you need. Uh-huh. And so there was sort of a convenience factor there that I was just like, I don't want to be sitting here eating salad for an hour every day to get the quantity I need. Right. Yeah. So I got to do chicken or whatever. Yeah. And, so no, I didn't try and cut it out 100%, but I kept it to the one meal a day kind of thing. And, found that I felt really light. I've recovered well. I slept well. Yeah. So I just went with it.
Yeah. If you're not an athlete, you probably don't understand the notion of like getting bored of eating, but mm-hmm. I've been there too. I had a problem with my weight getting too low because I simply just like eating. I was just bored of it. Like I had to eat so much. Yeah. I mean, at one point in my career, I was running 100 miles a week and you have to eat a lot of stinking food to not get, you know, really obnoxiously skinny. So.
Right. Well, you have like this big plate and people always said to me, like, to your point, like, I'm so jealous. You could just eat whatever you want. I was like, it wouldn't have worked to do cheeseburgers and French fries all day. But also like, it's not fun to eat that much. Like you have to push yourself to expand your stomach just as much as like expanding your muscles or stretching or whatever. Like you really have to go there, and push yourself in while eating to the point of discomfort and, you know, it's hard work to consistently consume 6,000-8,000 calories a day, and then burn it on the same and the same day or the next day, right?
Yeah. So during this time, did you have a job with the training, or is just this full time?
Previous to 2015, like middle of 2015, and before that, I did have a job. I was doing a lot of commission only sales jobs because I was decently good at sales, and I had an interest in it, and it was flexible, so it worked out. When I was training that year, no job whatsoever. I was fortunate to have a lot of supporters, both financially and with, you know, places to stay and that sort of thing, and made it all work.
Cool. How much were you sleeping? You said you got, you know, pretty conscious about that.
Let's see. I think I was getting, 8 to 8.5, 9 hours at night, pretty consistently. And I was playing around with, you know, eye masks and earplugs and all of that stuff to really, you know, maximize that. And then I also was doing somewhere between a 30 and 60 minute nap during the day, between practices, almost every day. And so, I don't know, depends on the day, but, you know, total 9-10 hours between the two.
Did you find like earplugs, eye masks, special lighting, nighttime routine, anything like that seemed to work well for sleep quality, or was it just kind of a crapshoot?
Yeah. So I remember, it's funny because now that we're talking about this, I'm re-remembering. I wasn't a big journaler at the time. My wife, on the other hand, has like stacks of journals of what she ate, what workout she did, all of that. So it was just crazy, but that was not me. But I would do this nighttime pre-bed thing where I did like a cup of like whole fat yogurt, cornflakes and blueberries, and maybe something else. I can't remember, maybe like flaxseed or something. Because 8 hours, I would never go 8 hours, without sleeping or without eating during the day. So why would you do it at night? And that's kind of what our nutritionist was saying. I was like, okay, that works. I can get on that logic train. So I would start focusing on, I would do that, you know, drink a bunch of water, because I knew if I was getting up at least once in the, or ideally just once in the night to pee, I was going to wake up, be hydrated, to get going for the next morning. And then as soon as I was up, I was, you know, water and then the protein smoothie first thing, to get it going.
Cool. That's interesting. I haven't heard of somebody intentionally, getting up at the night to do, you know, extra stuff. I take that back. I've heard like marathoners. I don't know if you know who Alberto Salazar is, but when he was in marathoning, there's stories of him getting up in the middle of the night to drink water because he was training for like, it was going to be hot during that and he wanted to be hydrated and stuff. But that's interesting. So,
yeah, I mean, if you're just, you know, you think about it, you're asleep 8 hours and you don't have any food or water, like that's a long time for your body. So you, of course, you have to balance this for yourself. But like, if you're like, I was someone who I could like, basically still be asleep, get to the bathroom, pee and get back in bed and I would still be okay. And it would usually be about 3 something in the morning. So I had enough time to go back into REM cycle and come back out of it for normal wake up time. So it, my body just kind of found that balance and it had just got to be pretty natural at a certain point. But yeah, I also knew that about myself and that may or may not work for everybody. So it's you got to test that stuff for you.
Yeah. I think that's a very good point in everything that we talk about on this show is there's going to be things that work for you. There's going to be things that don't. And I mean, even in scientific studies, it's very rarely that 100% of the participants found, you know, that something worked for them. You know, we had an episode on tart cherry juice and how that's supposed to help with soreness and that kind of stuff, you know, but there seems to be a trend that it does, but it didn't for everybody, you know, so it might not for this person, depending on what your diet was before and what you were missing, that kind of thing. But cool. So we're getting towards the end of our time here, but I always send out an email and do some social asks when I before I interview a guest to see what does the audience want to know from Hans, the Olympic rower. So I have some questions here that are just meant 60 seconds or less answers for you from the audience here. So first question is, what was your favorite part of the Olympic experience?
There are two things. Number one was lining up on the day of the final. And then they, by lane order, they announce, you know, Poland, Germany, United States, etc. Like that was super cool. I'm like, damn, we're here.
Yeah.
This is it. This is the A final. Yeah. So that was awesome. Obviously the result of that race was not as awesome, but then after that, it was the gear for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you have a pretty sweet picture here on teamusa.org with your team jacket and stuff. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I have a lot of USA gear.
That's awesome. Okay, so second question. What was the, or who was the coolest person you met outside of the rowing community at the Olympics?
Outside of the rowing community, man. Oh, this is it. Al Roker.
Oh, really?
Me and a couple of the of my teammates were at a beach volleyball game on Copacabana Beach at midnight. I think it was USA Brazil, and that's a big sport down there. So it was just rocking. Yeah. And we left, and we were down on, we were walking out of the stadium, crossing the street. And then one of my buddies was like, that's Al Roker. And so we grabbed a selfie with him, and then I tagged him on Twitter, and he reposted it. So that was pretty awesome. Cool.
That's so cool. okay. And then last question here. And we kind of answered it before, but if you had to sum it up, why, in your biased opinion, why is rowing better than any other sport?
It's a perfect combination of personal exertion and teamwork, because you individually have to just kill it as an athlete, as a person, as an oarsman in your seat. Yeah. Your timing has to be right on, but then literally, like, there's no I in team kind of cliche stuff. Like, you're in the same boat,
yeah.
Literally in the same boat, right? And so you really have to trust your teammates. They have to trust you. There has to be a lot of working together, all of that good stuff. Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of fun that everyone does the same thing as opposed to other sports where you have various positions. Yeah. We're all literally trying to do the same exact thing at the same exact time.
Yeah.
And I'll leave you with this. Someone made the analogy of eight golfers trying to hit the same exact tee shot together 200 times in a row. That's rowing. So there you go.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a good analogy. So we'll end with that. But I want to let people know what you're up to now. Obviously, you've moved on. You have a career. So tell us where you're at, what you're doing, and then a little bit about the podcast that you have too.
Yeah, man. So I live in the Bay Area in Alameda, California, and I'm a realtor partner with the top real estate sales team in our geography called the Gunderman Group, which is a ton of fun. We sell some really cool houses here locally. And I'm entrepreneurial, so I have a podcast-related startup. I invest in real estate. I do a bunch of different things. And I also have a podcast myself called Another Way to Play, which is mostly focused on kind of the business aspect of like mindset training, but I've had athletes and I've had, you know, non-business people on there before, but it's think of it as like a career business mindset show.
Yeah. The world of business and sports kind of meld at mindset, I think.
100%.
So there's a lot of overlap there. So cool. Well, I'll have all the links to that in the show notes, Hans, but thanks so much for being on the show. It was great having you.
Rob, Jace, thank you for having me. I appreciate the invite, and good luck with all of your future endeavors, and have a great holiday.
Awesome. Thanks. You too. All right, episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jase, J-A-S-E, at scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.